Blog Talk Radio.
Good afternoon, everybody, and welcome to the Red Fox Blogger with your host, Kel Fritzy. I hope everybody is doing well today. I'm not doing too bad. I want to talk to you about inbreeding, specifically Islamic inbreeding. Now, I know you might think I'm picking on the Muslims, but I'm actually not. I'm trying to offer a service and how Islamic inbreeding is actually devastating to the West. There is an issue of massive inbreeding within the Muslim culture. It's been going on for 1,400 years. And like I say, it has done catastrophic damage, not only to the West, but it is doing catastrophic damage to their own gene pool. Now, the consequences of intermarriage between first cousins often have serious impact on the offspring's intelligence, their sanity, health, and on their surroundings. Now, the most famous example of inbreeding is in ancient Egypt, where several pharaonic dynasties collapsed after a couple of hundred years. In order to keep wealth and power within the family, the pharaohs often married their own sister or half-sister. And after a handful of generations, the offsprings were mentally and physically unfit to rule. Another historical example is the royal houses of Europe, where royal families often married among each other because tradition did not allow them to marry people of non-royal class. The high amount of mentality and mentally retarded and handicapped royalties throughout European history shows the unhealthy consequences of this practice. Now, luckily, the royal families, they have now allowed themselves to marry for love and not just for status. And, of course, we are witnessing that in England, Kate and William. The Muslim culture, though, it still practices inbreeding, and it's been doing it for longer than any Egyptian dynasty. This practice also predates the world's oldest monarchy, which is the Danish, by 300 years. Now, implications for the Western and the Muslim world. The consequences for offspring of consanguineous marriages are unpleasantly clear. Death, low intelligence, or even mental retardation, handicaps, and disease, often leading to a slow and painful death. Other consequences include limited social skills and understanding, limited ability to manage education and work procedures, and painful treatment procedures. The negative cognitive consequences also influence the executive functions. The impairment of concentration and emotional control often lead to antisocial behavior. The economic costs and consequences for society of inbreeding are, of course, secondary to the reality of human suffering. When cousins have children, they are twice as likely to have a disabled child. The reports of common insanity among children, clinical depression, and schizophrenia among all close inbred spells disaster, as Muslim demographics across the West show that most of European Union countries have no chance to preserve their own culture, and neither does Canada, the United States is holding on only because of Latino families. A huge Muslim problem? Inbreeding, from Rightly Concerned, by Brian Fisher, written by September 10th of 2010. The practice of marrying close relatives, which had been prohibited in the Judeo-Christian tradition since the days of Moses, was sanctioned by Muhammad and has been going on now for 50 generations, or 1,400 years in the Muslim world. This practice of inbreeding will never go away in the Muslim world, since Muhammad is the ultimate example and authority on all matters, including marriage. According to, there is a professor that I would like to bring to your attention. His name is, and if you will indulge me just for one quick sec, I want to bring up his name proper, Nicolai Senels. He is a Danish psychologist. Now I want to get back to my article. That's all right. We'll get there. According to Nicolai Senels, close to half of all Muslims in the world are inbred. In Pakistan, the numbers approach 70%. Even in England, more than half of Pakistani immigrants are married to their first cousins, and in Denmark, the number of inbred Pakistani immigrants is around 40%. The numbers are equally devastating in other important Muslim countries. 67% in Saudi Arabia, 64% in Jordan and Kuwait, 63% in Sudan, 60% in Iraq, and 54% in the United Arab Emirates and Qatar. Now, according to BBC, this Pakistani Muslim-inspired inbreeding is thought to explain the probability that a British Pakistani family is more than 13 times as likely to have children who receive recessive genetic disorders. While Pakistanis are responsible for 3% of the births in the UK, they account for 33% of children with genetic birth defects. The risk of what are called autosomal recessive disorders, such as cystic fibrosis and spinal muscular atrophy, is 18 times higher, and the risk of death due to malformations is 10 times higher. The risk of having an IQ lower than 70, which is the official demarcation for being classified as retarded, increases by an astonishing 400%, ladies and gentlemen, amongst children of cousin marriages. Senel says that the ability to enjoy and produce knowledge and abstract thinking is simply lower in the Islamic world. He points out that the Arab world translates just 330 books every year, which is about 20% what Greece alone does. In the last 1,200 years of Islam, just 100,000 books have been translated into Arabic, about what Spain does in a single year. 7 out of 10 Turks have never even read a book. Senels points out the difficulties this creates for Muslims seeking to succeed in the West. A lower IQ, together with a religion that denounces critical thinking, surely makes it harder for many Muslims to have success in our high-tech knowledge societies. Only 9 Muslims have ever won the Nobel Prize, and 5 of those were for the Peace Prize. According to Nature magazine, Muslim countries produce just 10% of the world average when it comes to scientific research, and that is measured by article per million, and that is per million inhabitants. In Denmark, Senel's native country, Muslim children are grossly overrepresented among children with special needs. 1/3 of the budget for Danish schools is consumed by special education, and anywhere from 51 to 70% of retarded children with physical handicaps in Copenhagen are of an immigrant background. Now, the bottom line, Islam is not simply a benign and morally equivalent alternative to Judeo-Christianity. pardon me, Judeo-Christian tradition. As Sennell points out, the first and biggest victims of Islam are Muslims. Simple Christian compassion for Muslims and a common sense desire to protect Western civilization from the ravages of Islamic dictates is a vigorous, is a vigorous opposition to the spread of this dark and dangerous religion. These stark realities must be taken into account when we establish public policies dealing with immigration from Muslim countries and the building of mosques in the U.S. In order for a culture to maintain itself for more than 25 years, there must be a fertility rate of 2.11 children per family. With anything else, the culture will decline. Historically, no culture has ever reversed a 1.9 fertility rate. A rate of 1.3 is impossible to reverse because it would take 80 to 100 years to correct itself. Now, in 2007, the fertility rate in France was 1.8, in which the fertility rate of Muslims was 8.1 children per family. So in France, there are now more mosques than churches, and the same could be said in the UK. 30% of children aged 20 and younger are Islamic. In larger cities like Nice, that number has grown to 35%. By 2027, one in five Frenchmen will be Muslim. In 39 years, France will be an Islamic republic. The fertility rate in England was 1.6 in 2007. At that same year, there were 3.5 million Muslims. The numbers are growing exponentially. We are now at 2013. The fertility rate in Greece at that point was 1.3, Germany 1.3, Italy 1.2, Spain 1.1, Canada 1.6, the United States 1.6, until the Latino influx is added, which brings us in the United States to 2.11. The numbers needed to barely maintain our culture. Across the entire European Union of 31 countries, the fertility rate in 2007 was 1.38, which is impossible to reverse. In a matter of years, Europe will cease to exist. Yet the population of Europe is not declining, and why is that? It's because of immigration. It's because of Islamic immigration. Of all the population growth since 1990, 90% has been Islamic immigration. In the Netherlands, 50% of all newborns are Muslims. In 15 years, half the population will be Muslim. In Russia, there are more than 23 million Muslims. That is one in five Russians. In Belgium, 25% of the population is Muslim. 50% of all newborns are Muslim. One-third of all European children will be born to Muslim families by 2025. Now, you're probably wondering why I'm throwing all these stats at you. Because we are packing the West with inbreds. We are packing the West with people who are recessive in a sense. They are not inferior by any means. They're human beings. These are people. But they are recessive in that they are the product of 1,400 years of inbreeding. And this is something that we have to be apprised of. This is something that we must be aware of. Take a listen.
Professor Rushton, how significant is the high incidence of marriage to first cousins for the IQ results among South Asians?
Thank you, Paul. That's a good question. There's some statistics that just came out showing that in England, South Asians comprise 3% of the population and 10% of birth defects. And one of the reasons people think is because first cousins are marrying one another. And if you marry first cousins who are married first cousins who are marrying first cousins, you build in its inbreeding depression. And we know that inbreeding depression also causes a lower IQ. And so it is certainly possible that some of that lower South Asian IQ is due to the marriage of first cousins. And we know that some people are saying that in Iraq and some of the Arab world, one of the problems in building a nation is that people are so tribal, which is like family-oriented, because the genetic inbreeding is such that your loyalty to your extended family is so much greater than it is here in North America, and we can... So cousin marriages is a big problem, and it's an interesting explanation for things.
Now, I am just here to give you an idea of what's going on out there, and I really want you to do further research. This is what I do. I tease you, and I make you want to learn something new. Go out there and do your research about what inbreeding means and what it means to the West and what it will mean in less than 25 years to your country, what it will mean for your grandchildren. I want to move on to something, though. I want to talk about the shoe bomber. We're all familiar with him, Richard Colvin Reed. He's the one on December 22nd in 2001. He was the 29-year-old British citizen. He was flying as a passenger on American Airlines Flight 63 from Paris to Miami. He attempted to ignite what other passengers described as a wire protruding from one of his shoes. I'm pretty sure you're familiar with that. He tried to ignite the fuse. He was subdued by fellow passengers, thank God. And it is speculated that the only reason why the explosive did not go off was because his shoes were damp. But if that bomb had gone off, it would have blown a hole in the fuselage and it would have killed all 197 people aboard. When the plane emergency landed at the tarmac, he was taken away. He was taken into U.S. custody where he stood trial and where he was found guilty. The case, the United States versus Reed. Now, are you familiar with the judge? Are you familiar with what Judge Young had to say to Richard Reed upon his sentencing? This is fascinating. This is amazing. This is from Judge Young. Mr. Richard C. Reed, hearken now to the sentence the court imposes upon you. On counts 1, 5, and 6, the court sentenced you to life in prison and in custody of the United States Attorney General. On counts 2, 3, 4, and 7, the court sentences you to 20 years in prison on each count, the sentence on each count to run consecutive, one with the other, that is 80 years. On count 8, the court sentences you to a mandatory of 30 years consecutive to the 80 years just imposed. The court imposes upon you monetary special assessments. The court imposes upon you 5 years supervised release simply because the law requires it, but the life sentences are real life sentences, so I need not go any further. This is a sentence that is provided by our statutes. It is a fair and a just sentence. It is a righteous sentence. Let me explain this to you. We are not afraid of any of your terrorist conspirators, Mr. Reed. We are Americans. We have been through the fire before. There is all too much war talk here, and I say that to everyone with the utmost respect. Here in this court, where we deal with individuals as individuals and care for individuals, as human beings, we reach out for justice. You are not an enemy combatant. You are a terrorist. You are not a soldier in any war. You are a terrorist. To give you that reference, to call yourself a soldier, gives you far too much stature. Whether it is the officers of government who do it, or your attorney who does it, or what happens to be your view, you are a terrorist, and we do not negotiate with terrorists. We do not treat with terrorists. We do not sign documents with terrorists. We hunt them down one by one and bring them to justice. So war talk is way out of line in this court. You're a big fella, but you're not that big. You're no warrior. I know warriors. You're a terrorist, a species of criminal guilty of multiple attempted murders. In a very real sense, Trooper Santiago had it right when first you were taken off that plane and into custody, and you wondered, where were all the press and where were the TV crews? And Santiago said, you're no big deal. Reed, you are no big deal. What your counsel, what your able counsel, and what the equally able United States attorneys have grappled with, and what I, as honestly as I know, have tried to grapple with, is why did you do something so horrific? What was it that led you here to this courtroom today? I have listened respectfully to what you had to say, and I ask you to search your heart and ask yourself what sort of unfathomable hate led you to do what you are guilty of and admit you are guilty of doing. And I have an answer for you. It may not satisfy you, but as I search this entire record, it comes as close to understanding as I know. It seems to me you hate the one thing that to us is most precious. You hate our freedom, our individual freedom, to live as we choose, to come and go as we choose, to believe or not believe as we individually choose. Here in this society, the very winds carry freedom. They carry it everywhere from sea to shining sea. It is because we prize individual freedom so much that you are here in this beautiful courtroom, so that everyone can see, truly see, that justice is administered fairly, individually, and discreetly. It is for freedom's sake that your lawyers are going to strive so vigorously on your behalf and have filed appeal. They will go on with their representation of you before other judges, that we care about it, because we all know that the way we treat you, Mr. Reed, is a measure of our own liberties. Make no mistake, though, it is yet true that we will bear any burden, pay any price, to preserve our freedoms. Look around this courtroom. Mark it well. The world is not going to long remember what you or I say here. Day after tomorrow, it will be forgotten. But this, however, will long endure. Here, in this courtroom, and courtrooms all across America, the American people will gather to see that justice, individual justice, justice, not war, individual justice, is in fact being done. The very President of the United States, through his officers, will have to come into courtrooms and lay out evidence on which specific matters can be judged, and juries of citizens will gather to sit and judge that evidence democratically to mold and shape and refine our sense of justice. See that flag, Mr. Reed? That's the flag of the United States of America. That flag will fly here long after all this is forgotten. That flag still stands for freedom. You know it always will. Custody, Mr. Officer, stand him down. And that was Judge William Young delivering his final remarks upon the sentencing of Reed. I have got just a few minutes left. I have a PSA for you out there, guys. Uh-oh, you're not going to like this, ladies. You cannot take your purses to the NFL games. No, don't bring your big purse. Don't bring your backpack. Don't bring your cooler to an NFL game this season, because they'll be banned, along with seat cushions and camera bags, at all NFL stadiums beginning with the preseason games. In a press release Thursday, the NFL Committee on Stadium Security said to provide a safer environment and to expedite fan entry. NFL teams will implement a policy that will limit the size and type of bags that can be brought into stadiums. Prohibited items include purses larger than a clutch bag, coolers, briefcases, backpacks, fanny packs, seat cushions, cinch bags, or camera bags. Game-goers are allowed to bring in bags that are clear plastic, vinyl, or PVC, and do not exceed 12 inches by 6 inches by 12 inches. 1 gallon clear plastic freezer bags are also allowed, though. NFLshops.com and club merchandise outlets will be selling official NFL team logos in clear plastic tote bags. Our fans deserve to be in a safe and secure environment. NFL Vice President and Chief Security Officer Jeffrey Miller said in a statement, "Public safety is our top priority. This will make the job of checking items much more efficient and effective. We will be able to deliver a better and quicker experience at the gates and also provide a safer environment. We appreciate our fans' cooperation." The statement said that stadiums will establish a secondary perimeter around the stadium where security will check for prohibited items. This establishes a protected buffer area for fans in plaza-level areas and at the gates for stadium entry. Any prohibited bag inside the second perimeter will be highly visible and more quickly resolved. Fans with bags that do not meet the criteria will be turned away from the stadium. The committee is encouraging stadiums to provide temporary storage facilities for banned items well outside the bag-restricted area. Well, there you go. They're trying to protect us again. Look at that, eh? However, mea culpa on the part of the NFL officiates. People who have medical needs will indeed be allowed to bring in any medical paraphernalia that they indeed need. However, those will be scrutinized very carefully. You know what I think they're doing, ladies and gentlemen? I think they're trying to avoid Black Sunday. Do you remember that movie, Black Sunday? Let me see. When was that movie? 1977. Starred Richard, what was his name? Robert Shaw. Yeah, Robert Shaw. You remember him more as Quint from the movie Jaws. Remember that movie when the Goodyear blimp flew over the stadium at the Super Bowl and people were running around? I guess they're just trying to avoid a Black Sunday. So, all the same, though, my deepest condolences to the ladies who enjoy their big purses and to the gents who can no longer bring in their knapsacks. Well, ladies and gentlemen, that is it. I'm out of time. I want to thank you all for being here. And yes, Jeff, you can bring your camel onto the plane. That's funny. But I really do want to thank you guys for being here. And I saw Jeff and Puppy in the chat room. I'm waving. I have one hand, so I can't type. I'm sorry. But I want to thank everybody else who listens on other devices, and who listens in archive, and I know you do. I want you guys to have a wonderful afternoon. I will see you back here on Thursday, 3 p.m. Eastern Time. Meanwhile, please check out my blog, Red Fox, if adults are watching, at redfoxblogger@blogspot.com. I always have, I hope, interesting and informative articles up there for you to peruse and share around. Okay, guys, thanks. See ya. Bye-bye.